all on a separate account. I don't have any personal involvement. She let a moment go by, then, earlier, I mentioned a development. Oh, yes, the development. I hope it's something good. Tell me one positive thing, please. I'm not greedy, just one. I truly am sorry to have to lay all this on you at once.
Yeah, me too.
He glanced at his watch. In fact, I have a time limit for hearing bad news, and we're way past it. The chair legs scraped against the bricks as he pushed away from the table, but he hadn't yet stood when she reached across and came an inch shy of placing her hand on his arm. Please, she said, I need to finish.
Finish telling me what this lovely stroll down memory lane has been for?
Yes.
Finally.
He spread his arms wide and, sounding like an ass again, said,
Let me have it.
This time she let it slide and went straight to the point. Did you know Eben Clark before the incident?
No. I'd never heard of him or his family until the breaking news story referred to their mansion.
Why didn't you attend his trial?
Were you involved?
No, I came to the case only recently, but while gathering background information, I read that you didn't appear at his trial. Why not?
In his sordid universe, Eben Clark was a celebrity. I was a bigger one in mine. I knew his trial would be a media event, which it turned out to be even without me there. My attendance would have added more sensationalism. The ex-husband and the current boyfriend battle it out in court. I didn't want to inflict that on myself or the Pratts. But I closely followed the proceedings. In my opinion, the son of a bitch got off way too light. And then, I couldn't believe it when I got notification a few months ago about a sentence reduction hearing.
She said, I did the research for the prosecutor who argued on behalf of the state and Rebecca. You had the right to be present and heard at the hearing, but you declined.
I declined to be present, but I sent my opinion to the judge.
Yes, your statement was read in court. In essence, you urged the judge to keep Clark in prison and to throw away the key.
Little good it did, he said.
Your argument might have carried more weight if you'd delivered it in person.
I doubt it. The upshot is that Clark got his sentence reduced. Last I heard, the judge was deliberating by how much.
Well, he's made that determination. Taking into account the 2 years Clark has already served and the allowance given for good behavior, he's being released.
On parole?
Without any provision.
You've got to be fucking kidding.
I wish I were, Mr. Bridger.
You mean he'll be let go? Free as a bird?
I'm afraid so.
When?
Today. Chapter 5.
It might not have been the best idea to give him a $250,000 Porsche as an early release gift.
Sid Clark smiled as he poured two bourbons, one for himself, one for the family attorney.
It's a turbo, top of the line.
Silver, red interior, I saw it parked out front. A splash of water in mine, please.
Because they always drank their whiskeys neat, Sid gave his friend a puzzled look.
It cuts the calories, Upton said.
That's self-deluding.
I'm very good at that. Sid laughed as he added the requested splash of water, then carried the drinks over and they clinked glasses.
Here's two.
Here's two. They drank. Sid sank into the matching leather chair beside the one occupied by Upton Franklin, who, in addition to being Sid's highly paid legal counselor, was also his sounding board, tennis partner, golfing buddy, poker rival, and best friend since they'd met during their first semester at Georgia's most elite prep school. Their friendship had been forged by bullying classmates they disfavored for one reason or another, and playing pranks on humorless faculty members who insisted on gentlemanly conduct and strict adherence to school rules. By their senior year, Sid and Up practically ran the academy, having cowed even the austere headmaster with their genial terrorism. Once out in the business world, their bullying had continued, but they'd refined their methods. Sid was the brain behind their schemes to steal companies out from under unsuspecting CEOs. Upton was the legal mind that maneuvered them around the laws and regulations of commerce. Today, the international conglomerate they'd assembled was worth billions and included numerous industries. They were two of a kind, each possessing ruthless ambition and a blatant sense of entitlement, which was why Sid was surprised by Upton's chastening remark about Eben's new car.
"Why the frown, Up?"
Upton swirled his watered-down whiskey.
"If you'd asked for my advice before buying the car, I would have suggested that you give him something less costly and conspicuous. A wristwatch. Carved marble chess set. Rare breed of dog."
Sid chuckled.
"So I splurged. What of it? He's been in prison."
Forehead furrowed, the attorney said,
"Exactly my point, Sid."
"Which is escaping me."
"Some might think giving Eben a flashy car to mark the occasion of his early release to be in bad taste."
"I don't give a damn what some might think."
"Obviously not," Up said. "But perhaps you should. I advise a little discretion. Restraint. Eben should avoid drawing attention to himself, the early out notwithstanding."
"Whenever you say notwithstanding, I know you've lapsed into lawyer mode."
"I'm speaking as your lawyer and friend. The early out notwithstanding, Eben was still convicted. The girl
was not a victim. It was a tragic accident, and as much her fault as Eben's."
"The jury didn't think so."
Sid sneered.
"Everybody but that 12 knew better. That was not Rebecca Pratt's first rodeo."
Upton looked at Sid from beneath his shelf of eyebrows.
"But it was her last."
Sid didn't concede the point, except a curse before taking a drink of his bourbon. When he lowered his glass, he said,
"She was drunk and high, and she went into a bedroom with three men who admitted to being equally drunk and high."
"Because admitting to being stoned mitigated their responsibility for the catastrophic outcome," Up said.
"Remember the DNA evidence? She'd had sex with all three of them."
"Yes, Eben's defense lawyer was emphatic about that in his closing arguments. He described in some detail the sex acts they had engaged in."
"He described a nymphomaniacal contortionist," Sid said, and chuckled.
"Sid, please."
"All right, that was uncalled for. But suffice to say that prior to that night, she was a well-documented party animal, and those are the least offensive words I could use to characterize her. At Eben's trial, Theo and Cal testified under oath that all the fun and games were her idea."
"But it was in their best interest to testify to that, wasn't it?"
Up argued.
"Their lawyer was negotiating a deal for probation with no jail time."
"Which Eben served."
"Because he's the one who took the experimentation too far."
"Don't sound so goddamn self-righteous, Up. You and I had menages on occasion."
"We did, yes, but none of the women wound up in a vegetative state. Rebecca Pratt did, and even though Eben is now a free man, people aren't going to forget that. He needs to be aware that he'll be closely scrutinized, to be seen blazing around in a new sports car."
"Blazing around is precisely what I had in mind."
The subject of their discussion strode into the study, wearing a broad smile and the best casual chic Sid's black Amex card could buy. Eben was only a few months away from turning 30, and it made Sid proud when people said that the older he got, the more they favored each other. They had the same slender build, wide forehead, and cleft chin. Their eye colors differed. Eben's were a cool gray-green and all his own. Halfway across the room, he stopped and looked from one to the other. "Obviously, I've walked into the wrong party. I was invited to join you for happy hour. This is your idea of happy? You look positively glum." Sid motioned him toward the bar.
"Pour yourself a drink."
"Oh, I intend to." Eben vigorously rubbed his hands together as he went over to the built-in wet bar, a component of the elegant floor-to-ceiling cabinetry that enwrapped the room except for the wall of windows. He clunked ice cubes into a glass and reached up for a decanter of vodka. Why the sour face up? And by the way, I was joshing. I don't plan to blaze around. I'll break in my new car like it was a baby stroller. Scout's honor. He carried his drink over to the sitting area and tapped glasses with both men before flopping onto the sofa. He drank from his late mother's finest cut crystal, then gave a long ah of appreciation for the vodka as he rested his head on the tufted sofa back. Thinking of moments like this was what kept me sane during my incarceration. He gave an exaggerated shudder. God, am I ever glad that my debt to society has been paid.
I'll drink to that.
Sid raised his glass in a toast. He noticed that Upton was slower to raise his. After they'd all taken a drink, Sid said to Eben,
Frida cooked a prime rib for dinner. Your homecoming gift from her.
Sounds delicious. She can make me sandwiches with it tomorrow. Tonight, I'm going out. Sid felt the glance Up sent his way, but he pretended not to notice it.
I thought you would want to have dinner here with us.
Sorry, I'm sure you two will do justice to the prime rib, but I've made other plans. Casually, Sid asked,
Big plans?
Cal and Theo wanted to take me to dinner. God, it seems ages since the three of us had been together. He shook an ice cube into his mouth and crunched it. Upton cleared his throat.
Maybe this fresh start should include cultivating new friendships, even.
We'll see. He shot them a smile, then after a beat said, Look at your glasses. Nearly empty. We can't let that happen. He got to his feet, picked up their tumblers, and carried them to the bar for a refill. Over that round, Eben was brought up to date on the goings-on of business associates and social acquaintances. At one point, he quipped, The good, the bad, and the ugly. They spent a convivial hour. The only wet blanket among them was Upton, who maintained an uncharacteristic reserve. Eben seemed not to notice, but it annoyed Sid, who couldn't account for it. After polishing off his second drink, Eben stood. I'm meeting the guys at one of our haunts. I think they may have secretly scared up some of the old crowd. So if this is to be a surprise party, I don't want to be late. He went around Upton's chair. From behind, he gripped him by both shoulders and gave them an affectionate squeeze. See you later, Uncle Up. Thanks for celebrating with me. Upton reached up and patted the back of Eben's hand.
Be careful in that snazzy car.
Play your cards right and I'll take you for a spin. I may even give you a turn at the wheel. As he approached Sid, Sid stood up and shook hands with him. When they broke, Eben looked down to find that Sid had slipped him a money clip containing several $100 bills. He whistled.
Thanks, Dad. Enjoy yourself, but do as Up said, and be careful.
Eben pocketed the money, then headed for the door. There he paused and turned to blow them a kiss. Don't you boys stay up too late? His laughter followed him down the hallway. Sid sat back down and smiled when he heard the sports car growl to life out in the drive. He looked across at Upton, who was frowning into his second drink, which he'd barely touched. Sid said,
All right, I'm spoiling him. You've made your disapproval obvious. But he deserves...
Sid!
Upton raised his hand palm out.
I don't believe you want to get into a discussion about what Eben deserves, or what any of us deserve.
What's with this mood? Cheer up, for God's sake. Finish your drink.
No, I've had enough.
Up placed his glass on the small table at his elbow. Sid gave him a lingering look. They'd known each other since adolescence. Upton wasn't being pompous or cranky. He wasn't sulking. He was genuinely bothered about something.
Tell me what's the matter.
After having avoided direct eye contact for the last half hour, Upton looked straight at him now.
You think Eben's early release is cause for celebration?
It's not.
It is. But I don't believe it's occurred to either you or him what ramifications it may have.
Such as?
Does the name Catherine Lennon mean anything to you?
No. Should it? Who is she?
A smart, savvy, ambitious state prosecutor, hand-picked by the Attorney General himself.
A politician in the making?
No. She's much more interested in criminal cases, and she's not afraid to tackle tough ones. In other words, Sid, she's Eben's worst nightmare.
Chapter 6. Zack scaled the challenging incline. It was the steepest, the hardest, the home stretch of his punishing workout. His leg muscles were burning, heart was drumming, lungs working doubly hard to draw in air. At this altitude, it was thin. Several times a week, moving at a rapid but safe clip, he made the trek from his house down to the river and back up. He pushed himself through the last 100 yards, cutting himself no slack. Following his inglorious exit from the NFL, he'd packed on an extra 20 pounds. After his day of reckoning with the sports network that had forced him into an early retirement, he'd awoken one morning with the mother of all hangovers. He'd puked and dry-heaved for 5 minutes, after which he gave himself a good hard look in his bathroom's full-length mirror. The damn thing was merciless. Who the hell was that bloated, spongy, sorry excuse for a man staring back at him through bloodshot eyes? Zack was disgusted by him. He despised him. He decided he must go. Then and there, his naked self had resolved that he would not continue down the road he was on. For one thing, he didn't want to give those who'd predicted he would self-destruct the satisfaction of smugly watching from the sidelines as he inexorably degenerated. He'd retained just enough fortitude to make a vow to himself to get his shit together. He might be ridiculed and scorned for past failures and bad behavior. That censure he deserved. But he would never let them say Zack Bridger had fallen from grace and then gone to seed. That morning of his epiphany, he'd poured out every bottle of booze he had in the house, made a shopping list of healthy foodstuffs to replace the crap his pantry and fridge were stocked with, and had outlined a rigid and rigorous exercise program for himself that even Bing would have approved. Bing might even have said it was excessive. The first workout, which in previous years would have amounted to a warm-up, had nearly killed him. But within 8 weeks, he'd dropped the extra 20 pounds. Then over the course of the next couple of months, he lost another 10. That had brought him down to his pre-NFL weight, and it was all muscle. He was leaner, and if not meaner, then sure as hell harder, his soul as well as his body. Now, quads on fire, he covered the last arduous yards to reach the rocky ledge that marked his stopping point. He slowed to a normal walking pace and moved in a circle as he used the app on his wristwatch to check the pedometer, his time, his vitals, all the things he kept track of. He flipped his ball cap around backward and lifted the hem of his t-shirt to wipe sweat off his face. After drinking from the water thermos clipped to his waistband, he leaned against the rough trunk of a pine tree, closed his eyes, and waited for his respiration to regulate. He tried to empty his mind and let his thoughts simply drift. Instead, they channeled straight back to Kate Lennon. "You can call me Kate," she'd said. But from there forward, he hadn't called her anything, because after she'd dropped that H-bomb piece of information about Eben Clark on him, he'd considered their meeting concluded. He'd stood up so fast, he nearly knocked over his mini chair. As it was, his thigh had caught the edge of that teeny table and sent it to rocking. "I'm out of here," he said. "I've got to go before the market closes." "It's open till 7 p.m. And he'd said, "The stock market." And she'd said, "Oh," and checked her wristwatch. "Time has gotten away from me, too. I have a Zoom meeting in 15 minutes. She'd shouldered the bag that he could have packed for a weekend. "But you and I have more to talk about." "No, Ms. Lennon, we don't." That's when she'd invited him to call her Kate. But he hadn't. All he'd said was, "Goodbye. Thanks for the coffee." Not wanting to scare her or any of the other customers in holy ground, he'd gotten the hell out of there. Because he was about to explode. Like he had that time against Green Bay's right guard who'd taken an extra pot shot at him that had been ferocious enough to knock his helmet off. Before he even realized what he was going to do, he had laid into the guy. It had felt like attacking a mattress, but his teammates practically had to peel him off the asshole. The officials went nuts with their whistles. Both coaches were apoplectic. The Packer had been ejected from the game, but still, Zach had never been that angry. Not until this morning, when he learned that they'd let that son of a bitch, Eben Clark, out of prison. He wanted to attack the whole damn legal system for allowing that. It must have been obvious to Kate. What the hell? Why not call her Kate? That the miscarriage of justice had lit a short fuse in him because she had let him go without protest, saying in his wake something about contacting him soon. He didn't stop to tell her not to bother, that he saw no point in talking about it further. Rebecca was still locked in a vegetative state. Clark was free. Thinking about it, talking about it, rehashing all of it was pointless. Dwelling on it only served one purpose, and that was to make him miserable. It had taken him all this time to extricate himself from that darkness, and it was still dusky. He didn't want to be drawn back into it, not by anybody, but especially not by Kate Lennon, who was bad news personified. Although she did have that cute butt, and he'd enjoyed watching her lick the vanilla-flavored foam off her upper lip. So while he never wanted to lay eyes on the woman again, laying down with her was an enticing fantasy. He muttered a stream of swear words, pushed away from the tree, and continued along the forest trail that had been charted over time by his own footsteps. He knew the landmarks along it like the back of his hand, and by now avoided them almost by instinct. As he approached his house, he heard something that made him slow down and then stop altogether to listen. It hadn't been a natural sound, not leaves stirred by the wind or a squirrel's scolding chatter, not a bird's flit from one branch to another, nor the incessant white noise created by the waterfall. The sound had been man-made. He flipped his cap back around and pulled the bill down to just above his eyebrows, then continued along the familiar path, being careful not to step on a twig or loose rock or anything that could signal his approach. As he crept through the trees, his house gradually came into view. First, the clearing, an apron of hardy grass that surrounded the house itself. Next, the north-facing exterior wall dominated by the stacked stone chimney. Then the porch that ran along the entire length of the south side. Zach stopped. The oversized front door marked the center of the porch. The door was flanked by large windows, two on each side of it, one of which was being peered through by a man in a law officer's uniform. His cupped hands formed blinders that were pressed up against the window pane. His Smokey the Bear hat was occupying the seat of Zach's rocking chair, and that pissed him off more than anything. Still unmoving, Zach looked several degrees to the left. A Bronco was parked in the cul-de-sac. Its all-business tires were caked with mud. It had a serious light bar on the roof, a heavy-duty grill guard, and an official insignia on the door. Zach's porch had one plank that squeaked when stepped on in a certain spot. He realized now that was what he'd heard, not the vehicle's engine, as it had come up his drive, indicating to him that the cop had been poking around his property while he was ascending the mountainside. Zach emerged from the cover of trees. "See anything interesting in there?" The man spun around. His expression gave away his embarrassment at having been caught. Then he gave a shrug and a grin. "Mr. Bridger? Zach Bridger? Your truck's here." He thumbed over his shoulder towards Zach's pickup. "I figured you were at home, but hadn't heard my knock." "Bullshit." Zach walked toward the porch, but he didn't say anything. He wanted to hear first what this guy sporting a shiny badge had to say. As he came down the steps, Zach sized him up. He was shorter and stockier than Zach and spent a lot of time lifting weights. His buzz haircut suggested former military. He had a tattoo on the side of his neck, some kind of symbol, but Zach couldn't tell what it was. He had a swagger, just a shade off belligerence. He'd been looking Zach over, too. "Been out hiking?" "Mm-hmm." Zack glanced beyond the guy at the window through which he'd been peering.
What have you been doing?
The officer closed the distance between them and extended his right hand.
Deputy Sheriff Dave Morris.
Zack shook his hand.
The deputy grinned. Of course I already know who you are.
Zack acknowledged that with a curt hitch of his chin.
You've lived here for a while now.
3 years.
Funny that our paths have never crossed.
Not so funny,
Zack said.
I don't go down into town that often.
Yeah, but I don't stick to town. I'm out and about all over the place, he said, making an expansive gesture. But I heard you keep to yourself. Don't like company.
Who'd you hear that from?
He didn't answer. Instead, he looked westward at the sun that had just sunk below the crest of the mountain across the river, casting Zack's property in shadow. When Morris came back around, he hiked up his belt, which seemed to have the entire inventory of a police department's arsenal attached to it. Zack supposed the move was made to signal that he was getting to the purpose of his visit.
Mr. Bridger, the folks over on the eastern face.
Over on the eastern face, there aren't any folks left. Green Ridge Incorporated has run them all off.
I was referring to the folks of Green Ridge Incorporated.
Zack had known that, of course, but he said,
Oh, pardon.
Well, they've been experiencing some, vandalism to their property.
Vandalism.
Nothing real serious so far, but it's a nuisance, and added up, it's costly to repair, replace, and clean up the damage done.
What damage?
They've had their signs removed or defaced. Windows of buildings under construction have been broken out. Last night, a backhoe had some rather crude messages spray-painted on it.
Zack just looked at him and said nothing.
So they asked me to come over here and check on you, see if you'd experienced anything like that, had any intruders.
Not until 5 minutes ago.
Morris dropped the friendly manner.
I'm not an intruder.
A window peeper, then?
I represent the sheriff's office.
You're official.
Damn straight.
Then the next time you want to look inside my house, bring a search warrant. But you won't find a can of spray paint because I don't own one. And if I wanted to deface a sign or a backhoe, I wouldn't leave a message for those Green Ridge folks that was rather crude. It would be downright obscene.
Everybody said you're a jerk.
Zack placed his hand over his heart.
That really hurts my feelings.
He stepped around the deputy, mounted the porch steps, and picked up the hat lying in the seat of his rocking chair.
Don't forget this.
He sailed it toward Morris like a frisbee. Just as he did, a familiar vehicle pulled up behind the deputies. Inwardly, Zack groaned. This day would go down in the record books as being majorly shitty. Chapter 7. Kate couldn't fathom what a sheriff's unit was doing here. Friendly call or official business? She got out of her car and passed between the rock columns into the yard. No, not friendly. At all. The tension between the two men was palpable. Forcing herself to smile, she said, Hello, gentlemen. You two know each other? Am I interrupting? Zack stood on the porch in the deepening shadows, a mute and antagonistic presence. But the deputy was smiling as he ambled toward her.
Hi, Kate.
Hello, Dave.
What brings you up here?
I have business with Mr. Bridger.
Is that so?
That's so.
Since it became apparent that she wasn't going to elaborate on the nature of their business, he said,
How was the trout?
Great.
Grilled to perfection, just as you promised. Glad to hear it.
Thank you for the recommendation.
Anytime.
Zack still hadn't spoken a word, which was unnerving and provoking, but unsurprising, considering their previous encounters. She continued smiling at the deputy. They'd been introduced shortly after her arrival in town. Since then, they'd seen each other often enough in and around the DA's office to put them on a first-name basis. He said,
Have you tried the zip line yet?
I haven't worked up enough courage.
Nothing to it. I could show you the ropes, so to speak.
She gave the expected laugh.
But we need to do it soon, he said. They shut down at Halloween and don't reopen till Easter or so. Check her schedule. Let me know what day is good for you.
Her eyes flicked toward the porch.
I will, thanks.
He put on his hat and brushed the brim. See you soon, then. Be careful on these roads. They can be tricky for anyone not familiar with them. Don't get caught up here in fog.
I'll keep that in mind.
He glanced over his shoulder. See ya, Bridger.
You bet.
He made the two words sound like, not if I can help it. Kate called up to him.
I'll be right with you. I need to get some paperwork out of my car.
She and the deputy walked together toward their parked vehicles. He said, isn't it after your office hours?
I had a full schedule today. Business spilled over.
What business have you got with Bridger? She kept her smile in place, but stated firmly,
confidential.
He took her answer with grace, but said, watch yourself with him. He's not a pleasant person.
He suffered some very unpleasant experiences.
The deputy gave a snort of disdain. Hard to work up a bleeding heart for the MVP of the Super Bowl. He looked down at her, as though expecting a response. When he didn't get one, he said, well, anyway, bye now, Kate.
Bye.
He walked to his truck and climbed in, giving her a little wave as he drove away. Kate opened the passenger door of her car, but it wasn't paperwork she retrieved. Flat rocks embedded in the grass formed a pathway to the porch. She made use of it and, reaching the bottom step, hefted a bottle of wine by the neck.
I brought this.
What for?
To drink?
Haven't you heard? I'm a drunk.
Okay, then, I'll drink the wine and you can be broody and bellicose. But whatever, we've got to talk.
We finished talking.
We just got started.
Whatever it is can keep till...
No, it can't. In fact, time is running out.
On what?
Even Clark is a flight risk. Which was the truth, just not the whole truth.
He's out. No provisions. He can fly wherever the hell he takes a mind to go.
That's right.
Then what?
The sun's gone down and it's getting cold out here. She lifted the bottle again. Are you going to invite me inside?
He kept her waiting for about 10 seconds, then mumbled something that had the word bellicose in it and turned to face the front door. He punched a code into the keypad on the jamb. The lock clicked, and he pushed open the massive door and motioned her inside. There were no lights on, but when he depressed a wall switch, lamps from various points around the vast room came on.
Oh, my, she exclaimed. This is gorgeous.
Thanks.
She walked forward several steps, then stopped and made a slow 360. The walls of the room were comprised of split logs held together with cream-colored mortar. It had a massive fireplace on the wall to her right and a wide, open staircase attached to the wall on her left. In between, area rugs created islands of color and pattern against the hardwood floor. Directly in front of her was a two-story wall of windows that provided a view of the gorge and the waterfall in all their glory. A second-story gallery encompassed the room on three sides. When her pivot brought her back to him, she said, I confess that I'm flabbergasted and impressed.
What did you expect?
Nice, but not something out of Architectural Digest. Did you design it?
I had the basic concept in mind. An architect took it from there.
It was beautifully executed, and the best thing about it is that it fits you so well. He raised his eyebrows.
How's that?
Well, I mean, what she meant was, where else would a man like him look more at home? His hair was long enough to curl from beneath a baseball cap that must be a favorite, because it looked like it had seen decades of wear, or war. His T-shirt was also vintage. He wore a flannel shirt tied around his waist by the sleeves. His army green cargo shorts were faded from repeated washings. His hiking boots had red laces, thick socks were cuffed above them, and he smelled of the woods and resin and healthy sweat. He was waiting for her to reply. She groped, then said, well, I mean the scale of it and all.
Oh, he said, giving a nod. Most things aren't built for 6'4 plus.
She laughed.
I wouldn't know how that feels.
He looked her up and down. No, if you went wandering off in here, you could get lost.
A beat, then,
and I'd have to come looking for you.
He didn't say it as a tease. He didn't add a wink. Without a jest behind it, the statement took on weight. Unintended, no doubt.
They looked away from each other at the same time. An awkward silence followed. Then both began speaking at once.
Are you still... What did...
He motioned for her to go first.
She said, I was going to ask what you and Deputy Morris were talking about.
You mean Dave?
This time, he did sound as though he was poking fun, but she didn't rise to the bait. Instead, she asked what he'd been about to say.
I was going to ask if you're still cold. I could start a fire.
She glanced toward the fireplace.
That would be nice, if it's not too much trouble.
No trouble. It's already laid. All I have to do is start it. Bar's over there. Corkscrew is in the drawer.
On his way over to the fireplace, he took off his cap, tossed it onto an end table, and ruffled his hair. He also untied the flannel shirt from around his waist and put it on, but left it unbuttoned. He set aside the fire screen, then knelt and used a lighter to ignite kindling beneath logs that had been expertly stacked. She went over to the bar, which was recessed into the wall. It had a small fridge and ice maker. Above the granite counter, drinking glasses were lined up on subtly lighted glass shelves. Four highball glasses, four wine glasses. On a shelf all its own was a single bottle of bourbon, looking very mellow with the soft lighting shining through it. Hearing him coming toward her, she quickly opened the drawer and got out the corkscrew.
Let me, he said, moving up beside her.
I can do it.
I'm sure you can.
He took the bottle and corkscrew from her anyway, deftly handled both, and pulled out the cork. He took down one of the wine glasses and poured a goodly measure of Pinot Noir into it. As he passed it to her, he said,
I would have figured you for white wine.
Why?
I don't know. Just would. Maybe because your hair is so light.
Their gazes held for a second or two. Then hers moved to the bottle of bourbon. For a drunk, you certainly stock expensive whiskey. One side of his mouth tilted up.
I gave up being drunk and disorderly, but not good sipping whiskey.
He reached for one of the highball glasses and poured two fingers of the bourbon.
I allow myself a drink on special occasions.
What's the occasion?
First fire of the season.
Ah.
They made their way over to the fireplace. The young fire was casting flickering light. He indicated that she'd take the sofa facing it, while he sat, more like sprawled, in an adjacent chair positioned at an angle to the hearth. She said, I'm guessing that's your favorite chair.
In the fall and winter.
What about spring and summer?
The rocker on the porch.
No Barker lounger?
Oh, hell yes, in the TV room upstairs.
They smiled across at each other and drank from their glasses. She said,
You never answered my question about you and Deputy Morris. Do you two have a history?
Nope, just met. We didn't exactly take to each other.
I gathered. What happened?
Rather than answer, he asked a question of his own.
He recommended the trout. Why does that not surprise me?
What's wrong with trout?
It swims.
She laughed. We bumped into each other at a local restaurant. He was coming out as I was going in.
You two seemed chummy.
Not chummy, exactly.
More than chummy? Y'all have a thing going?
She sputtered into her wine. Good Lord, no.
Not for his lack of trying, I think.
The truth was that Dave Morris had shown more interest than she'd invited or welcomed. His flirtation had put her off, not enticed her. But she wasn't going to go into that with a man who'd yet to address her by her first name. He said,
Morris did the same thing you did yesterday.
What did I do yesterday?
When you got here, you said, Mr. Bridger? Zachary Bridger? Like you didn't already know who I was. If you didn't know, why would you be coming to my house?
You're right. I apologize. Honestly, I do. Of course I knew you.
Then why'd you pretend not to?
I was nervous.
Nervous? You?
He snuffled a laugh.
I'd have never guessed that.
Well, good. I pulled off a confident air.
Why were you nervous?
Come on. You're Zach Bridger.
No.
Appearing regretful, he said.
I used to be.
People still get starstruck. He raised one shoulder in a negligent shrug.
Some people.
She took a sip of wine, looking at him over the rim of her glass.
My roommate had a poster of you above her bed.
He groaned.
That thing. It was for charity. The league sold the poster to raise money for cancer research awareness.
It raised awareness, all right, she said, around a laugh. He'd been featured shirtless, wearing low-slung jeans and a come-hither-if-you-dare smile that every female fantasized was just for her.
It was killer.
He winced.
Can we change the subject, please? I can't believe I'm saying this, but I'd rather talk about Morris, the trusty deputy.
When I got here, you two seemed on the verge of pawing the ground.
I returned from my hike to find him on my porch, hands cupped around his eyes, peering through that front window.
He motioned toward it with his glass. What for?
That's what I wanted to know.
He explained the reason for the deputy's visit.
I don't suppose you...
He shot her a look.
Painted a nasty message on a backhoe? No, wasn't me. I'm not the only person pissed off at those people who are carving a golf course out of the forest and stacking up condos on the mountainside.
They want to do that on your mountainside, too?
Hell will freeze over first.
He set his glass on the coffee table and got up to attend to the fire, which by now was crackling pleasantly. He used a poker to readjust the logs. Sparks chased up the chimney. The new flames picked up strands of copper and gold in his brown hair, reminding Kate of the yummy trail that had been a much-admired feature of that poster. She took a sip of wine, then another, then cleared her throat. How did the stock market do today?
Up and down, closed okay.
He returned to his chair, settling back into the plush cushion as he fixed a shrewd look on her.
Is that what you came all the way up here after hours to ask me? You can find out how the market did on your phone.
Busted. She leaned forward and set her wine glass next to his glass on the coffee table. She shouldn't have drunk it without eating something first. It was burning her empty stomach. But the wine alone wasn't responsible for the mild upset. She dreaded the next few minutes. Although she deliberated on how best to approach the subject, she determined that there was no easy way. Nevertheless, she would wade in cautiously, not take a plunge. She said, "Have you ever heard the phrase, a year and a day?"
"No."
"Well, it was a common law, a judicial standard that had stood for centuries, but which, over time, has been abandoned, although it does have limited applications in some places, depending..."
"Cut to the chase."
"All right." She had an illustration prepared. Say you had a bank robbery back in the 1880s. To frighten people, the robber fired his pistol randomly, but one of the bullets struck the teller. He was critically injured, but he survived.
I think I saw that movie.
She pressed on. The robber was charged with aggravated assault, convicted, and sentenced to serve 5 years.
With you so far.
The teller never fully recovered from the near-fatal gunshot. He suffered repeated infections and complications. Affected organs became dysfunctional. His incapacitation became more severe. Slowly, Zach sat up straighter and leaned forward toward her.
Where's this story going? I'm not liking the sound of it.
Bear with me. I'm laying groundwork. Similar to what you did this morning when you described your marriage to Rebecca. For context, you said. He frowned, but said,
"Fair enough. Continue."
If the bank teller continued to deteriorate and died within a year of the robbery, the robber could be charged with manslaughter or even murder. But if the teller lived a year and a day after the event, the robber could not be held responsible for his death and couldn't be charged with it.
That extra day makes a difference? That's bullshit justice.
Which is why that common law no longer applies. Medical advancements have enabled people to survive injuries that otherwise would have been fatal. There have been cases where the victims of violent crimes remained alive for years before they succumbed. The assailant, who might or might not have been convicted of a lesser crime, could, upon the victim's death, be charged with murder or manslaughter if it's proved that the injuries sustained during the commission of the crime ultimately cost him his life. Many of these cases have gone as far as the Supreme Court. They've been precedent-setting. He assimilated all that, then said, "What's this got to do with Evan Clark?" He committed an act that placed Rebecca's life in danger. He used his hands, but hands can cause bodily harm or death. Therefore, they're a weapon. He was charged, tried, and convicted of aggravated assault, a felony. But the judge who reviewed the case has determined that since Clark's intent was not to harm Rebecca, he should have been charged with simple battery, which is a misdemeanor. Misdemeanors are punishable by less than 1 year's incarceration. He served 26 months. Therefore, she raised her shoulders. What kind of fucked up judicial system would allow him to walk the streets? Well, it might be effed up, she said. But we do have a judicial system, and it could be used to see that Eben Clark receives the punishment he deserves, which I believe should be life imprisonment.
I wish, but retrying him for the same crime would be double jeopardy.
She took a deep breath and in a quiet voice said, not if he's now charged and tried for murder.
He can't be charged with murder as long as Rebecca is still...
He broke off. It was plain to her that understanding had struck him like a bolt of lightning. She hoped he sensed the compassion she felt for him at this moment, hoped her voice would convey it. Eben Clark can't be brought to justice as long as Rebecca is still alive. Chapter 8. Eben had endured the obligatory happy hour with his father and Upton, but he'd been itching with impatience to make his escape as soon as possible. He'd fibbed. His friends hadn't planned this dinner out. He had. And he'd insisted that Cal and Theo join him. No excuses, he'd said. For the occasion, he'd chosen a restaurant that had been one of their favorites. In the heart of Buckhead, it was exclusive, expensive, and hip. A spot in which to see and be seen. When he pulled up in his new car, the awestruck parking valets motioned him into the VIP space near the canopied entrance. God, he loved being kowtowed to. How he'd missed it. Since the so-called victim of his crime had been Zach Bridger's ex-wife, he'd been afforded no deferential treatment from fans of Bridger's in Reidsville, which had amounted to just about everybody, guards and cons alike. But even Clark was free and ready to party, and he wanted to blare it to the entire world. However, upon entering the restaurant, he experienced a crushing letdown. While he'd been away, the place had undergone a metamorphosis. He couldn't quite put his finger on why the vibe felt different. Well, actually, he could. It no longer had a vibe. It barely had a pulse. The hostess was a brunette knockout wearing a short, tight black dress that showed a good 2 inches of cleavage. But her eyes didn't light up with recognition when he sauntered toward her. Instead, she asked for his name and put it on a list. A list? The previous bartender, who'd made a perfect dirty martini and told great dirty jokes, had been replaced by an indifferent automaton. He had little to say, and his martini lacked a pleasurable sting. Eben was becoming depressed. Then Cal and Theo walked in. The hostess indolently pointed them toward the bar. Eben came off his stool and spread his arms. Finally! What took you so long? He grabbed Theo first and pulled him into a man hug, thumped him on the back several times, then pushed him away to arm's length. Where's your hair gone?
Screw you.
Eben laughed and turned to Cal. Come here, you son of a gun. He gave Cal a similar hug. When he set him away, he said, Tell me it isn't so. You got married? Married? That's right. On purpose? I was afraid she'd never say yes. How is married life? I'm happier than I've ever been.
He even turned to Theo and spoke out of the corner of his mouth. What else is he going to say? Theo chuckled. Cal smiled, but the quip didn't elicit a swap of good-natured put-downs that Eben had expected it to. The hostess approached and said, "Your table is ready, sir."
Sir? How old did she think he was?
She seated them in a semicircular booth, Eben in the middle. They toasted his early release with a round of drinks. But by the time they'd finished their shared platter of raw oysters, Eben was wondering where his playmates had gone and was asking himself who these two stodgy substitutes were. He blamed most of the buzzkill on Cal. If ever there was an argument against matrimony and monogamy, one only had to compare the old Cal with this humorless and uptight incarnation. Marriage had drained him of all vivacity and humor. The old Cal Parsons had never turned down a dare. He'd been game to try anything and everything. Tall, blonde, rangy in build, he only had to give a woman his sultry smile and off came her panties. His success with women had been the envy of Fraternity Row at the University of Georgia. The envy of Eben Clark in particular. His wife, whatever her name was, had ruined him. She'd made him dull as dirt. By nature, Theo Simpson was self-effacing and studious. He'd never possessed Eben's and Cal's daring do, and only their corrupting influence had saved him from being a hopeless bookworm. Under their guidance and goading, he'd shed some of his reserve, but Eben wondered now if he'd relapsed into his former circumspect self. Wearing his characteristic lopsided grin, he listened attentively to Eben's exaggerated stories about his time in the zoo and the still-evolving species he'd encountered there. Theo laughed in all the right places, but underlying his laughter was his annoying inbred caution. He frequently glanced at Cal as though seeking approval for his levity. That began to grate on Eben, because since they'd founded their friendship during rush week at UGA, he'd been the ringleader of the trio. Of course, he'd always footed the bill, too, making his leadership role undisputed. They finished their steak and lobster combos and ordered dessert.
How about a round of Louis XIII to wash down the chocolate mousse?
None for me, Cal said.
Come on, my treat,
Cal shook his head.
Thanks, Eben, but I've got to drive home.
Eben guffawed. You drive better drunk than you do sober. Cal smiled, but it was strained.
I'm out of practice.
Eben rolled his eyes. Jesus. He turned to Theo.
You won't turn it down, I know. I'm going to pass too, but you have one.
Just because he could, and because he wanted to establish himself as a big spender with the robotic barman, Eben ordered the cognac. Ceremoniously, the hostess brought it to their table on a silver tray.
For you, Mr. Clark?
Yes, but call me Eben.
She smiled as she set the snifter in front of him.
Enjoy.
As she walked away, he said,
What I'd enjoy is getting her on her knees. What do you think, boys? Would $100 bill buy me a blowjob?
Shh, Eben, please.
That from Theo, as he looked around anxiously. Cal said nothing, just stared down at the tablecloth as he traced the weave of the fabric with the tip of his finger. Eben pressed himself against the back of the booth.
What is it with you two?
For an answer, he looked first to Theo, whose leg was jiggling beneath the table.
Well?
Theo said,
After what happened, it would look bad, sound bad for anyone to overhear you saying things like that.
Oh, for Christ's sake.
Cal raised his head from his study of the tablecloth and glared at him.
No, Eben, for our sakes, mine and Theo's. You're out.
But we have another year of probation left. Eben divided a look between them.
Oh, I get it. You're jealous that I beat the system.
Cal sat perfectly still for an extended time, then calmly took his napkin from his lap and laid it on the table.
You didn't beat the system, Eben. You bought it.
He pushed back and stood up.
Thanks for dinner.
And just like that, he left them. Eben felt flushed,
not from the embarrassment of having a guest walk out on him, but from rage. He shot the cognac like it was rot-gut rye. As he returned the snifter to the table with a hard thump, he said, "I didn't hear him complaining when I was shelling out money for week-long parties in Cancun. I bought the dope he did, the booze he guzzled, the girls he fucked.
He didn't mean..."
"Hell he didn't. And stop that goddamn jiggling. It's driving me to distraction." Under the table, Theo's leg went still. He gnawed on his lower lip, fiddled with the stem of the strawberry that had garnished his chocolate mousse, and eventually worked up his courage, something he'd always had to do before engaging in even the mildest of disagreements, like whether or not hot dogs were better with slaw or chili.
"Here's the thing, Eben."
Eben raised his hands from his sides and appealed to the ceiling. "Glory, hallelujah, let me hear the thing." Theo deliberated for so long, Eben wanted to slap him to see if he was still conscious. At long last, he said,
"The thing is, we can't pick back up where we left off. We had some wild times, but they got out of hand, and then they caught up with us, big time. That business, what happened, was a wake-up call."
"It was a timeout." Theo shook his head.
"It changed things forever."
"It didn't change me."
"Well, it did Cal and me, especially him, because I never did party as hard as you two. He has a lot more to live down."
He glanced toward the hostess stand, where the young woman had returned to her post.
"He's not looking to score."
Eben formed a heart with his hands.
"Because he's a married man."
"Yeah, he is, and he's all in. He loves Melinda, and she adores him."
"Can you name a woman who didn't?"
"No,"
Theo said with a wry grin.
"But when he met Melinda and things got serious, he made sure she knew about his past. He owned up to all that wild shit we did, and she loves him in spite of it."
Quietly, he added,
"She loves him in spite of Rebecca Pratt. That will be a damn hard thing for a woman to accept and forgive."
Theo picked up the stem of the strawberry again, looked at it as though puzzled as to how it had come to be in his hand, then dropped it back into the dish.
"Even if Cal wasn't devoted to his wife, he's got to stay on the straight and narrow for another year, Eben, or he'll be slapped in prison. That goes for me, too."
Eben stabbed his index finger into the table as though driving a nail.
"Don't forget that I'm the one who actually went to prison."
With rare boldness, Theo said,
"Which was only fair. You're the one who actually did the deed."
Chapter 9. Eben Clark can't be brought to justice as long as Rebecca is still alive. The sound waves of Kate's statement seemed palpable. Though softly spoken, it had substantial impact, and the odious implication of it wasn't lost on Zach. His declaration of refusal was equally hard-hitting.
"I won't do it."
He left his chair, went over to his front door, and pulled it open.
"Zach,
you could have saved yourself the drive up here.
Please, just
take your wine with you."
He left the door standing open and headed for the staircase. He didn't look back as he climbed up to the second level and walked along the gallery until he reached his bedroom. He went in and shut the door behind him. Then he stood with his back to it, rhythmically tapping his head against the wood, the heels of his hands pressed hard into his eye sockets.
"Jesus Christ."
He remained like that while a chant ran through his mind.
"As long as Rebecca is alive."
Kate Lennon hadn't said those words as a taunt, but the imps inside his head did. They repeated them in a diabolical sing-song. After minutes, he pushed himself away from the door and went into the bathroom, where he stripped off his hiking clothes and got into the shower. He turned the water on full blast, stood directly beneath the rainfall showerhead, and turned his face up to it. It had taken him 4 years to get his life to the point where it was at least comfortable. He had his home, he was financially secure, he was in the best physical condition ever. He could go into a coffee shop and not be hounded by either devotees or detractors. He would never have total anonymity, but he was close. Primarily, he had what he'd most coveted, distance from the tragedy of Rebecca. Now this. But suddenly it occurred to him that this unexpected development didn't have to change anything. He could leave things exactly as they were and let the future play out as it would without any participation from him. He didn't have to do a goddamn thing. He wouldn't. He'd told Kate Lennon, "I won't do it," and he'd meant it. He would take a knee. Having resolved that and feeling marginally better, he scrubbed himself from head to toe. He pulled on a pair of sweatpants and a t-shirt and left his bedroom. From the vantage point of the gallery, the silvery crown of Kate's head shone like a beacon. She was still seated on the sofa, gazing into the fire, although the front door was no longer standing open, so at some point she'd gotten up to close it. Even though he was barefoot, she heard him coming downstairs and turned her head. He said,
"It won't do you any good."
"What?"
"Whatever it is you're going to say, I want you to leave."
"I know how difficult this must be for you." He gave a bitter laugh.
"You have no fucking clue."
"Then enlighten me, Zach. Talk to me."
"I'm through talking. Bye."
He motioned toward the front door, then headed for the kitchen.